This episode of Disposable Heroes was brought to you by EcoSox. EcoSox was founded upon the idea that providing a better product at a comparable price using a renewable material is beneficial in many ways. So why did they choose bamboo as the renewable material? So it's cooler when it's hot, it's warmer when it's cool, they keep your feet nice and dry, they like pull the moisture away from your feet during the day, it's amazing. Bamboo is the softest and most comfortable fabric you will ever wear on your feet. Yassad promises that, I swear. Otherwise, this episode is free. Oh, wait. It is free. It's also odor eliminating. For some strange reason, it doesn't actually smell. I could wear Eco Socks 3 days in a row. As long as you let them dry out overnight, they do not smell. It is bizarre. So they've aired them out and used them for as many as 10 days, and they've remained odor-free. The bamboo just doesn't collect the odor like cotton does. So anyway, head over to eco.com. That's EEKOE.com and get a pair for yourself.
We want to thank Skivvy for bringing you this episode of Disposable Heroes. Skivvy makes premium boxer briefs that keep you on top of your game. And my favorite ones are, they're the sports ones. They're like the stuff that they put to cup women's breasts. You guys got it going on. Skivvy's committed to taking a product that you take for granted to a whole new level of personal comfort and style. Make sure and go check them out at skivvy.com. It's SKVI.com. All right. Aloha. Hope you guys enjoyed Disposable Heroes, Episode 11, Part 1, with the absolutely delightful Mark Shepherd. And now we give to you Part 2. All right.
Who are your drum heroes? Who made you want to play drums?
John Bonham was definitely one of the first, like, that my like dad and uncle turned me on to. And then when I got into kind of like the reggae thing, it was probably a lot of it was Sly Dunbar, obviously, and with Sly and Robbie, because all, you know, on the realization of all those Black Uhuru records, and then even going on to a lot of the early dance hall with the early Barrington Levy records and all those. So
that's a word I haven't heard in a long time.
Yeah. So hearing like all the, and then Stuart Copeland, cause you know, I realized, oh, he's kind of got the punk rock and rock thing melded with the reggae thing. So that was a huge, mind blowing kind of realization to me. And, Lars from Metallica.
Lars is a weird thing.
Yeah. I gotta admit, if it wasn't for, Injustice for All, I might not have started playing drums.
That makes sense. Yeah. A lot of people have said that.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't know that he's a drummer's drummer, but he's every drummer's secret.
Yeah. Well, I don't like to, in my opinion, like, and I say this with the utmost respect for Lars, yeah, is, he maybe technically isn't the greatest drummer in the world, obviously, but creatively, he just blows my mind with those parts he's written.
He's a perfect song drummer.
Yeah, parts he's written for some of the songs that are just such the part of the fabric of my youth.
And, it's a pretty amazing thing to be able to say that nobody else could have done it better in that weird way.
In that sense, you're right.
Yeah.
With any song, with any mm-hmm. piece of music. And that's the same with Charlie. Charlie was never a technical drummer. Charlie Watts was never a technical drummer.
Right.
And yet
he just served the song well.
There is a story that Steve Jordan, who's one of my heroes, definitely one of my heroes.
Oh man, well,
that man can play.
Yeah, the Continuum record. Oh, that, like, you talk about just those drum parts.
Him playing with the Blues Brothers. Yeah. I mean, it's like, right.
Steve
Jordan.
He's
doing Al Jackson's parts, and you're going like, what the hell is he doing? It's beautiful drumming. Mm-hmm. But he was playing with Keith when he played in the Expensive Winos.
Yeah,
Richards.
I read Keith's book,
and the great thing of him going, stopping him after a day's rehearsal and saying, it's great, but could you play a bit more like Charlie?
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. I don't want you to hit that snare and hi-hat together whatsoever, man.
Better not happen.
But there's a thing about it. When you listen to, like, Can You Hear Me Knocking, or you listen
yeah.
to...
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure.
Nobody else could have played that stuff.
Yeah.
Nobody could have done it.
Yeah.
There's those, and you start to appreciate it more as you get older. Did you know, Public Image Rise? You know the song Rise?
No.
May the road rise with you.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Anger is an energy. The amazing Public Image record. Mm-hmm. It's called Album, I think, here. It's called Album. Know. It was called CD. It was called Tape. That's what it was called. It was a brilliant title. But we'll put it on a little later just to remind you. It's Tony Williams playing drums.
Oh, shit.
I'm like, it's Tony Williams playing drums on a punk record.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You start going, wow.
That's crazy.
With the parting, with unfortunately Tom Petty passing and Bowie passing and this
We
stuff.
Just played Kaboo the same day as Tom Petty. We watched him the night. That was the second. I think that was the second to last show because he played at the Hollywood Bowl after that.
Yeah,
or?
My buddies went to the Hollywood Bowl and go to the show.
Yeah, man.
That was like one of those shows where I actually got reintroduced, not reintroduced, but I got into Tom Petty again.
Yeah,
because
you have
of
to.
No, because of the documentary about Dr. Dre.
Oh yeah, the Defiant ones.
Yeah.
Because they have like a whole section about Tom Petty, and I remember watching the drummer.
Because of Iovine.
The original, Iovine.
Stan Lynch is one of my heroes, too.
Dude, his drum groove for
Breakdown.
Yes, that chorus.
Yeah.
Dude, I'd never
nice call, Mark.
I didn't actually pay attention to it. It's like the sign of a really good groove to me is like you can't really, you think it's simpler than it actually is.
He starts the song and the audience screams. That's a drummer starting a song.
Yeah. Right.
And,
right. Like, great point.
That is iconographic.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like Kenny Aronoff's drum fill in Jack and Diane. It's like In the Air Tonight. I'm not a Collins fan, but blah 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 blah.
The beginning of Rock With You. The beginning of Rock With You.
Oh, God, perfect drum fill.
Yeah.
And then anything ever recorded by Motown.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. Dude. Well, it's funny that you're talking about
two drummers. Two funk drummers brothers, on a lot of those.
Yeah, the Funk Brothers. But sometimes they don't know which one's which.
No.
That's the joke. Sorry, you were saying.
No, I was just going to say, you're talking about Gad being out of his head when he came in. It reminded me of the bass player.
James Jameson.
James Jameson.
Playing Let's Get It On.
Yes.
It's one of the greatest stories ever.
Yeah.
On his back, doesn't know the song. Listen to the bass part in the song and go, he has no idea where the key changes is, and it's the greatest bass line I've ever heard.
Yeah, so it's crazy.
That's his a triumph voice. Of talent over technique.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? It's just in him.
There's no chart.
It's just in him.
But apparently he was smacked out and in a bar.
Yeah, when they called
and
him.
And they pulled, he's on the floor on his back. Mm-hmm. I mean, he played that on his back. The Funk Brothers that's the saddest story ever. Nobody knows who those guys are.
Yeah.
All those amazing documentaries.
I got to go to a thing that SWR put on to honor James Jamerson. His whole family was there. And they had like the bass player for Stone Temple Pilots up there. They had a bunch of other jazz bass players. They had, oh my God, six or seven. They had, what's his name?
We'll get it.
Motown hero. How am I? Stevie Wonder.
Oh, gotcha.
Came out and played with the band, and the whole thing was just a tribute for James Jamerson. You know, his brother's a ridiculous bass player too.
Of course.
I mean,
he was, but James was slightly better.
Yeah.
That's how those stories went. So, you get to play. He's not so good.
Yeah, he was A++++. Well, it's funny, speaking of where we're at right now in the South Bay, you talk about the old jazz of like the 50s and whatnot down in Hermosa. And all of the Hermosa Pier and the Lighthouse and the Sea Sprite Motel and because when we
that was
first
a whole scene wasn't
it? Totally.
I actually walked by the Lighthouse this morning, got my Starbucks and walked by it, and I looked at that building and I was like, that building itself, if you just
those bricks, if those bricks could talk,
they've got the new owner who shall remain nameless. Ended up covering up an entire wall of 50s jazz signatures on the wall.
Oh, man.
Probably didn't know what they were.
We hope so.
God.
Benefit of the doubt, I like it.
That guy's going to hell if he didn't know who they were.
Some things are sacred. Yeah. Some things just are.
Just like,
you cut the wall out and give it to somebody.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I'm from Hawaii, and like, everything with the old Hawaiian land to, a lot of stuff is super sacred. So
it's a different belief, and you don't own the land.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the point.
And some things need to remain sacred, in my opinion, absolutely.
And, without tourism, Hawaii wouldn't survive. And
it's double-edged sword.
You've got that thing. It's like Catalina Island is exactly the same thing. It's like,
yeah.
There's people who were born there.
Yeah. Totally.
People forget. It's not just like some weird island they built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You know? But it's, you know, I'm fascinated. I think the world is such a strange place right now. And I think because of the immediacy of the internet and everything that's so quick. And
yeah, it sped everything up so much.
You're using Pro Tools, right?
No, yeah. You're
not. Yeah, you are using Pro Tools. And I remember, you remember the days when we couldn't do this without a giant desk and we couldn't do this without, you know, 80 times more equipment than this.
I'd still prefer to use a giant desk and tape machine personally.
Well, there's a feel to it. That's
yeah. Well, you speak
I'm a tactile person too, so.
Our first album, our second album, technically Conatown, was recorded all on 2-inch tape, and you should have seen the pile of tape from editing my drums on that thing. You know?
Yeah,
but it was such a rad experience, though. Of like, wow, look at him cutting. He's got to cut the tape to edit it and put it together. The huge board and
I produced a record for what was going to be a record for Kristen Vigard, who sings backups with Peppers and Trudio Disgracius and all those bands. She was in all those. And I have the 2 inches for that. I have Ampex tape in my
tape's so awesome. Like,
there's something to it, and there was something about the bleed. And Dave Jordan was a great friend of mine. And Dave was I think he was working engineering on with Roy Thomas Baker back in the day. And they said they were doing Bohemian Rhapsody and they could see through the emulsion. They were getting to the point where the bounces were so heavy that they were scared to death. They were losing the emulsion on the tape.
I have the Pro Tools session
for
that.
I have the 24-track, yeah.
It's awesome. No, it's 16.
It is 16, isn't it?
Yeah, which makes it even more impressive.
The overdub snare on the vocals at the end, which is amazing.
It's crazy. So,
and you've got Stevie's on that one. You've got Marvin Gaye on that stuff. I was given that a while ago.
Yeah, the Marvin Gaye one's pretty good too.
You can mix the two. You can mix Marvin and Stevie together at the same beat.
I love that. Like those just make the rounds.
Yeah.
To like.
Well, that's what. Remember the Gray album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was the
genius.
Well, yeah. Danger Mouse. What year was that? That was. I mean, that was such a beginning of almost this whole electronic thing we have going on
that
here.
Because like 2004, 2005, I think.
Yeah. And that was when anyone can do it was the idea, and that was great.
Yeah.
And it. Then you get this wave of everybody's doing it, which is not good. Mm-hmm. And then you'll come around to it going, when we find the heart in it, when we find the love in it, that's when you start going, yeah, that's great.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was watching Eminem's stuff from his rant
on
Trump.
Yeah.
I watched that last night.
Boy's a genius.
Oh, he is.
No matter what. My son looked at me. I remember my son, how old he must have been. He's 18 next month. He played me the first D12 record.
Uh-huh.
I went, this is genius. The first one.
Yeah.
It was amazing record. I'm like, this is incredible. He's going, he thinks Eminem is probably the greatest rapper ever.
Really?
Even taking into account
his bad years.
Yeah. But even then you go like his ability.
Yeah.
Is beyond.
Yeah. His technical ability is through next level. Like
he's not a pop star. Yeah. He's a man who works on what he does.
Yeah.
He's special.
Well,
he's
and you
really
think about
special.
You talk about hard work and being like there's nothing more valuable than hard work. It's all that work, and you think about a song like "Lose Yourself."
Yeah,
and that was the number one rock song, hip hop song. You know what I mean? It was.
You
all
can't argue that.
Yeah, no. And it's such a great song.
Well, what we had before that was "Walk This Way."
Yeah,
that was 100%. The last one we had before that made everyone go like, and that was Run DMC going. Going, who are these idiots?
Yeah. No, I know. Have you watched that Hip Hop Evolution?
Oh,
that's so great.
I laughed so hard. The looks on their faces, and then they suddenly hear the voice, and they go,
what?
Bastard can sing.
Yeah, totally.
Perry's, because I always thought it was sampled. It wasn't. They replayed.
I thought it was, too.
I would have sworn it was sampled. They were there, and he's playing the guitar, and they're like, this dude's really good.
Yeah.
But they were in their own bubble.
Well, and then Rick Rubin like forced that whole thing to happen too, right?
And he was so quiet back then.
Yeah, and then and then Russell's like telling his brother guys like, no, trust me. And from what they said, Run DMC was like, fuck there's this, no man. We're
it's
so
bullshit.
Over. And then next thing you know, changed their life forever.
Yeah.
And changed, a lot of other people's lives.
It changed Aerosmith too, I think.
Oh, it relaunched them into a whole new.
I mean, without that, I don't think we have the Armageddon soundtrack.
I think you're right. We don't have Alicia Silverstone in all those videos.
Right. Yeah.
And Steven Tyler's daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, that got a big grid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, there's a few of those.
That whole era of videos on MTV and, yeah. and but you, all, but all
you
that
can't,
was...
You can't beat Sugar Hill Gang. You can't beat...
No.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the core things. And I'm waiting for a few of those now. And I think they're coming because I think bands... To. I think bands are beating... Same way as mainstream television is losing to the Breaking Bads and the rest of the cool stuff and The Wire and all the fun stuff on TV.
Uh-huh.
I think... mainstream music, quote unquote, is losing to the fact that people are going, I want my music to mean something different to me.
Right. Yeah. And the way they're getting it now too, because it's like more with Spotify and things like that, where they're not being shoved necessarily these things in their face by the media and MTV and everything. And
have you had both? You've had straight record sales and you've had the era of no record sales. 100%.
Right? Yeah. We've experienced, because being a band for, we just hit being a band for 20 years.
Wow.
This last June. So, we've been through it all, because our first, Give It Up in 2005 got to like the top three of alternative
great
charts
record.
Or something.
Great
and,
record.
Yeah. And so, and records were selling back then. So, and I remember when things first started taking off and being like, wow, we're selling like 2,000 copies of Kona Town a week in LA alone and stuff like that. So we saw that side of it. And now we are, we have our own record label and everything, and we're seeing the, oh, we're getting this many spins on Spotify, and we got added to the Soak Up the Sun playlist. So, like, those are the victories now instead of record sales, you know?
Yeah.
And then I think that also equates to the fan having their own personal journey of finding music,
right?
And then owning it more when they do find it. And I don't know, it's rad. I think it's really cool.
I think a big thing of that as well is being honest, because if your fans can trust you,
yeah.
And they trust that you're not just shilling.
It's easier to put a facade of bullshit up with all the social media and everything these days. That's why.
Well, I have that problem. I've got a wonderful fandom that, you know, I've a lot of followers on Instagram, as you know, and mm-hmm. a lot of followers on Twitter. But they're so genuinely kind.
Yeah.
And I think it's my job not to be fake, if I can possibly not be fake, and not mm-hmm. to say this is great when it's not great. If I think something's great, I can go, this is great, and maybe put it into the hands of other people and something, say, I want to share this with you.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, the monetization of it all, which is very, very complicated.
Yeah. That's what I think too, with that whole, I think the trust that you're talking about in your fans and whatnot is, that's why we started Law Records, our record label, because yeah. we're fans of the music that we put out, and we just think that our fans need to hear this. And if they like it, they like it. And most times they do, because a lot of like-minded people that are very open-minded in the same sense. So.
Well, it also translates to the fact that when you go out and you play a concert, you know how many people know the words of your songs.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the telling point.
That's true.
It's not down to how many t-shirts you sell. It really isn't. I mean, although it's a wonderful indicator and it's a fantastic thing. Merchandising is the backbone of what we do now, I guess, in that way. But
that's going to go up and down, though. You know what I mean? People knowing every word to a song will be with them forever.
That's incredible. That to me is. I mean, there's that thing about Petty. I remember the first time I heard the Pack Up the Plantation live album, which is probably one of the best live albums ever made. Stevie Nicks comes and sings backing vocals on two or three of the tracks. Mm-hmm. But he does Breakdown. Talking about Breakdown, just remember the Breakdown. The drums start, and that little noodle comes in the guitar. You know. No, but, but he doesn't go into the part yet. Yeah. You know, it's like, and they're playing doom doom sa doom doom da doom sa doom doom da doom sa doom doom da doom sa doom 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 doom, and the audience starts singing. They sing the first verse. They start going into the second verse,
right,
and then into the chorus, and he just goes, you're going to put me out of a job.
Yeah. You just reminded me of something we did on a Pepper tour. Do you remember I can't remember the tour, but we played like our pre-show playlist
right.
during changeover were all songs that we thought people would sing along to.
Right.
And we wanted to see who they sang along to the most. And you could tell, because like all of a sudden the crowd would just start singing like what's a big banger, like Sweet Caroline in Boston would go off like crazy.
That's perfect,
right? Of course, but Petty was a consistent everyone sang along.
Yeah.
So and cool. I just now remembered that from you saying yeah. that. Because I'd be setting up pre-show and I'd be like, God damn, they're doing it again with Tom Petty.
Yep. And you know what that equates to is all, it's like a big pool of memories that mm-hmm. is just exploding in the crowd because of that song yep. and the words that are related to the memories that they have.
Yeah.
And that's where that
you're
beauty.
Right. He's connected to me to when I was 12. He's yeah. connected to me through my life.
Yeah.
Different songs or periods of my life. And that's an artist. That's an yeah. incredible artist. Bowie's the same for me.
Always different for every person.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's beautiful.
I'm not a huge Traveling Wilburys end of the music.
Right,
end,
right.
But I mean, I love it. He's an amazing musician. But the songs, Here Comes My Girl. It's like, oh, yeah. I was talking about that with Luther. He's like, listen to what that song's about, man. It's like, the world's fucked up. Everything's wrong. It's fucked. But here she comes. Here comes my girl. And yeah. now everything's all right.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, oh.
Don't Come Around Here No More.
Don't Come Around Anymore.
Live
yeah.
blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like the way that they broke it down. And then when they go into the double time part.
Faroni is one of amazing. The best drummers. He's a lovely guy. I've known him off and on for many, many years. You remember he played on Cocaine. He's the drummer on.
No way.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
On.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Think of the fills. You know.
Wow. Oh, and he's a traditional grip. That's right. That build, because they break it down so much that it's only just the backup singers doing that. Don't come around here no more. And that's it. And it's like 45 to 50 seconds of them singing that over and over again. And then Steve Faroni does this. And then they go into the double time part, and I was just like
Stan's parts on the original are genius. I mean, they're genius.
Yeah,
the stuff with Stevie Nicks, to find that those two could sing together,
yeah.
and the sound they made together,
yeah,
it's like, oh my god, they sing beautifully.
Yeah, well, that was the Iovine, right? Iovine. Like he was like, Petty, I really need this song, man.
You were doing something. You played a song earlier before we started recording that made me think of this, and then you reminded me again with Breakdown.
Yeah.
I think that, and tell me if I'm wrong, if you disagree with me, I think the hi-hat in the 70s was far more important
yes.
to the groove than it is today.
Hmm. Very much so.
And it like it's kind of lost its luster in a way. Like it's not used in the same way.
Everything that was funny, everything in the Police's hi-hat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what Stuart Copeland was.
Stuart's stuff was all slap echo on hi-hat stuff. Mm-hmm. That was his thing in his part of reggae.
Well, he used to run his own tape echo, like that he stored like right on top of his hi-hat live.
So crazy.
But you're right. We've got this whole era of like mashing the hi-hats.
Right.
And no definition.
Yeah. And I think punk rock had a little bit to do with that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I think like the 80s metal scene kind of.
Well, yeah, because think about that. The double kick. Two kick drums led to the clutch where you just release the clutch
and it
just sits there and is just the
totally
washy.
Right.
Yeah.
But like that.
So I went to remotes for that reason because I hate that.
Yeah.
I got remotes. Closed remotes.
Yeah.
So I can go.
Which, totally.
You know. Beat the crap out of that one.
Yeah.
It's like, but
I just feel like it's lost its kind of, and then with electronic music, it's kind of been reintroduced, but not quite as much.
I'll play a song that we did live at the Troubadour. Robin is just hi-hat. The whole song's hi-hat and bass drum.
That's awesome.
Wait, is that the one? I remember you telling me about this at Zildjian. How you were just holding that.
Blood blister came up on my thumb.
I remember the story.
God. Yeah. That's always fun.
I had my 17-year-old son sitting on the side going, it was one of those things. I'll play it to you later.
Do you play traditional grip? Or?
No, badly.
Yeah.
I can play pretty well with my right hand, but that's no good.
I can. Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, me too. My right hand traditional grip, amazing.
Absolutely. No use at all. No. Not very good with the left hand hi-hat.
Yeah.
Weird.
I could play open to it.
Right.
That's funny, is that? It's like, oh, that's easy. It's like, no, it's that way.
Yeah.
You know, this week I saw that Scorpions and Megadeth, their last show before they canceled
Did you see it?
Yeah, I went and saw it last weekend.
My friend Ivan went and saw it.
And Mickey D from Motorhead's playing drums for Scorpions right now.
Oh, I know Mickey,
Yeah, and it was the sickest old school. His drum riser was on a scissor lift for his solo. They raised him like 100 feet in there. It was just so old school. And I text Fasano right after I saw it.
You know why we do that? It's because you can't see our bald spots.
Right. Oh, that's why I got to do that then now.
Damn it.
But yeah, it was awesome. But he is a beast, man. Mickey D.
I remember Phil playing for them.
Yeah.
Phil Taylor was great.
Yeah,
those are the days.
How many they've been through? Scorpions been through a million drummers, right?
Scorpions,
Members. Like besides the two, I think the two guitar players and Klaus. Yeah, I think
I have a great respect for them.
Yeah,
but that's of an era that down here was a big deal. They sort of surf punk evolved more into that.
To be quite honest, I'm more of a thrash metal guy, so I went to see Megadeth.
Okay,
and like of course, like Scorpions, I kept hearing. Oh, I remember my mom and dad rocking this in the mid '80s. That every song I heard, I was like, "Oh, this one! Oh, this one!"
Is that Rock Me Like a Hurricane?
Yeah.
Oh,
and that then
I don't even know if he knew what the words meant.
Winds of Change.
God. Yeah, that's right.
Which they use for that microwave commercial?
Yeah.
Are they sure?
Didn't they just do a Rock You Like a Hurricane commercial too for some like really shitty ad?
I don't know. They had to do the full like disclaimer. They ran like the donate to the hurricane relief funds like for two songs on the screens, then played Rock You Like a Hurricane.
Okay.
Hey, you know what? That's actually
I
have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah.
Fair play to them. I mean, there's some I went into DW, which is one of my great joys, is actually being allowed to go to a place like DW.
Yeah,
I'm sitting in the office. And
where's DW, the main?
In Oxnard.
Oh, it is? Okay.
It's so, they're a couple of warehouses there, and the place where they actually build the drums is there, which is so cool. So I was sitting in the office, in the A&R office, and Ainsley Dunbar came in. I haven't seen you, one of my total heroes. I haven't seen you since I watched you play drums in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he had this amazing conversation. He was talking about pedals, and we were talking about the 5000 and the 9000. I said, "Well, I went to the new machine chain drive pedal, which I love." He's like, "Oh, I've got a strap problem. I like it like this." And he goes, "I need to get this changed." And we were talking about stuff. I said, "So, you're still playing, man? You're playing all the time."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Yeah, but it's different." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "We get like two runs at a song, and they just cut it up and use it." And this is a guy who's played with Whitesnake, Bowie. He's played, in all the great eras of drumming, you know? And you
totally
go,
true.
And you go, you have somebody like that to record with. You go, thanks, done. And then you just cut his stuff up and quantize it.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Why would you hire a man?
It's like blasphemous.
That knows how to speed up in choruses, lag in verses, get bigger in bridges, you know, all that stuff that you've got just to take it back to this.
That I don't understand. I don't. I have a really good friend who's a great drummer. He rips, absolutely rips. And it took us, because like, I don't know if you remember, Yassad mentioned I was a recording engineer when I met them.
Of course.
So my whole background is all recording and music. And it took us maybe two or three sessions for me to realize that him and the click are not friends.
No.
And he and the band play much better
without it. And it has its own internal clock.
Yes.
And,
has his own internal clock, and it's good. And he's like almost self-conscious about the fact that he speeds up. And I'm like, why are you self-conscious?
Yeah.
It's like this natural thing. I did a bunch of work with Ken Scott, who's produced Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Yep.
And he was a big internal clock guy.
He had Woody Woodmansey then.
He had Woody Woodmansey. Yeah, yes. I actually got to work on a session with Woody Woodmansey.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was Woody. Woody flew in from London to do a weird thing. It was it never came to fruition, but it was a musical version of Cleopatra directed by Steven Soderbergh.
That makes sense.
Was supposed to star Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Interesting.
And because because the music had to be done before they shot, obviously, we spent an entire month in the studio next door they wanted the sound of the songs to be, it gets even weirder. They wanted the songs to sound like David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Like, they wanted it to sound specifically like Ziggy Stardust,
yes,
the album. Sonically, everything. So that's why they hired Ken. Because
and
Ken
Woody
recorded it.
Yeah.
And he was like, if you want the sound of the Spiders, you need to have Woody to play the drums. So Woody came in. We got an exact replica of his drum kit, all that.
Nice.
Wow. It was a really cool learning experience because I got to like work on this
and how to mic that tone.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And nobody knew it better than Ken, obviously. And but the songs were actually by this folk guy out of Ohio, who I can't remember his name at the moment, but he is one of those recluse, goes into his room for 48 hours, probably does a shitload of drugs, and writes 400 songs and records them and then puts them out on Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
And I can't... Oh, he was the dude from Guided by Voices.
Oh, yeah. I remember that guy.
So it was all Guided by Voices. It was all his songs done in this style. And we had this woman who knew all the songs. It was like... It was such a fucking mind fuck. Like, now that I think about it, it's so ridiculous. I actually have a drum head in there that was signed by Woody.
Of course.
And then we had Matt Bissonette playing bass. The guitar player was the dude that played Rusty. Wow, fuck, I can't think of his last name, but Rusty from Paul McCartney's band.
Yeah.
Played guitar. And it was just this weird experience, but getting to work with Woody.
What a drummer.
Amazing guy, too.
His whole family was here. I did a John Peel session, which actually is somebody sent me a copy, which is fantastic. So it was never released on vinyl. It wasn't one of the ones. John Peel was the great DJ, Radio 1, BBC Radio 1, who discovered all the bands, Susie and the Banshees, all that stuff. And they would bring the Smiths in and do a recording of them. And those things all went to vinyl. They've all been the John Peel sessions. They were quite really famous for it. Very dry guy, really funny, brilliant man. And I did a John Peel session. I remember being at home, turning the radio on, and recording it on a tape the first time it was played on BBC Radio 1. It was a big deal for me. The producer was Buffin from Mott the Hoople.
No way. That's awesome.
The drummer from Mott the Hoople.
That's my buddy Joe would freak out over that. He just passed. Did he really?
Yeah, he did.
I've never met anyone that's a Mott the Hoople fan. Personally, like a real Mott the Hoople fan.
Hey, Joe.
My buddy Joe, I think he flew out to England to do they did a reunion tour.
Yeah, with a different drummer.
4 or 5 years ago.
With a different drummer, because I'm pretty sure that Buffin couldn't play.
Yeah, anyway, Joe flew out and went to that. He's another recording engineer and huge Mott the Hoople fan. But yeah, I've never met anyone like that. That's what I mean. Amazing. I mean.
What's the name of the bass? Overhand Watts?
Yeah, it's something crazy
greatest
like that.
Greatest name of all time for anybody. Yeah. They were school friends. Yeah. Him and Buffin were absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Did you ever listen to Mott the Hoople, or did your parents?
You know Mott the Hoople.
Yeah, no, I don't think my parents ever did.
You know what song? All the Young Dudes. David Bowie wrote it for Mott the Hoople. Mm-hmm. The band was splitting up, and it was like, I'm going to write him a hit. So he wrote them All the Young Dudes, which was a hit.
Oh, yeah. No, my parents, I think, were more just on the, more of the glam side. Yeah.
It is glam. It was glam.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's the crazy thing. They're like, I think Bowie kind of just like.
I'm gonna blame that one on Hawaii, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
You'd love it. You go back to that. You go, this is really cool.
Nice. Yeah. Hey, noted. I will.
That's crazy.
And you're talking about Greg Bissonette's brother was.
Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, Matt.
Playing.
He's unreal on the bass. Both those guys are.
Isn't he an orchestral player? Wasn't he an orchestral player as well?
I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
That might be my favorite drum moment as a studio engineer.
Uh-huh.
Watching
Woody Woodmansey and him.
No, well that was great too. But watching Greg come in and do a big band session.
Oh, he's an amazing big band player.
He lives in South Bay, right? Or
no, I don't think so. I think he lives up in Hollywood. But his dad, was older, retired, and his dad was his drum tech.
Uh-huh.
His dad came down, brought the drums, set him up for him. Super cool. But then, Greg comes in, he's this big personality, and he's really quick-witted and fun, and he's known Wynn, the owner of the studio next door, for many years. And they have a quick chat, and then the librarian comes over with all the sheet music, and there's no drum sheet music for big band music. I don't know if you're familiar with this. So Greg goes, the librarian says, so Greg, you just want the trumpet sheet, right? And Greg's like, yeah, give me the trumpet sheet. And I was like, he wants the fucking trumpet sheet? Why would he want the trumpet sheet? Like, this makes no sense. And I can read music, not that great though. And he gets up there, and I realize
it's where all the stabs are.
That's where all the stabs are. So,
if he doesn't have those, he's got nothing.
Yeah. He's got nothing. And that was all he needed to play those songs.
He's an amazing technical drummer and a great big band drummer. I learned that same stuff from watching Levon.
Levon Helm?
Yes.
Yeah.
Watch what he does in The Last Waltz with The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, that stuff with all of the pushes and the Dixieland band behind him.
He's hitting
everything's about stabs and hitting on the pushes.
He's one of my favorites, man. He's awesome. Let's not forget his voice, too. Oh,
beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, gorgeous voice.
Up on Cripple Creek's one of my all-time faves.
It's a great song.
It is so... And if I that spring a, if I spring a leak, she mends me.
I don't have to speak; she defends me.
Yeah,
a drunkard's dream. If I ever did see her,
it's one of my faves, man.
Yeah, it's like that whole band was so talented. I remember the first time I saw that film.
Like, talk about chicken skin. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. The stuff that Rick Danko playing the stuff that he was recording, it wasn't going anywhere. That he was having. You know, the stuff that didn't, I don't think he even made it to the solo album.
Really?
The stuff he was talking about that he was in the studio that was playing in the background.
But
then
really?
They would cut back to Stage Fright.
Right. You know,
they'd cut back to, the greatest song was Stampede Doors. What's, and the sun don't shine anymore. Well, I remember the title of the song, but he's singing the lead, the two that he sings the lead on. Oh, what a song.
Yeah, he was
but that voice, to have that high part and sing bass, the whole Glen Campbell thing.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
He did that with the Beach Boys. And it's like, you suddenly start to realize the threads go through so many different bands that way.
Right.
Oh,
common threads.
I was just at my sister-in-law's house, and she's a huge music fan. And she has this poster up above there, like on the landing of their stairwell. And it was like, it's just a bunch of dots with like lines through them. And it says like the complete connections of rock. And I was like, I thought it was like a geology poster at first. And I walk up to it and I realize every dot is a musician. And it's all of the connections that each person is connected to.
So Jeff Beck, Steve Winwood, all those sort of guys, Eric Clapton.
Yeah. And the craziest thing is the bigger the dot, the more connections the person has. So like it was so weird seeing Charlie Paulson from Goldfinger has two connections because he was also in another band. Like there's a whole punk rock corner that's all like just punk rock guys. And then there's like
the- Was Charlie Paulson the bald guitar player?
Yeah, he was in another band called Black President and they were on there for some reason. I'm like, how, like Black President's a local like- Anyway, they were on there.
Yeah.
Sorry, that blew my mind. Yeah. And of course, the first name I see is Simon Wright, who played drums in AC/DC.
Yeah.
And in, did he play with Foreigner too?
Did he play in AC/DC?
Yeah. After
Phil left the first time.
He played with Dio too.
So wait,
he was the guy with the bald head.
The Thunderstruck.
Yes, I know he is. Yeah,
he's brilliant. He's the Thunderstruck
video.
Yeah, Thunderstruck, yeah.
And
he had the huge, they were like kick drums that he hit up on the side.
Giant gong drum.
Yeah.
So I see Simon Wright, and I'm like, oh, Simon Wright, what? And then there's all his connections, AC/DC, whatnot. But the funniest thing is all the solo artists don't have any connections. Like Bruce Springsteen just on a fucking island all by himself. it's like, oh, my God, that's brilliant.
You know the one person we haven't talked about, who we should have talked about, is Prince.
Oh.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That's like, to me, a man more important to music than almost anybody else in the 20th century.
What a great drummer.
An amazing drummer. Yeah. Could play any of the drum parts on any of his stuff and showed everybody how to do his stuff.
Yeah.
But had so much influence on music and yet is not thought of
as that.
As that person.
That's absolutely true.
Why is that? You think it's because his persona was so big that it almost like overshadowed his brilliance in music, which was so big in itself?
I
think people are scared of him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely the mystique was so.
He could dance better than anyone else. He could play guitar better than anybody else. Sing better than anybody else.
Yeah. Shorter
than everybody on the planet. And he could steal your girlfriend.
Yep. Yeah. 100%. And lock her in his hotel room or with him, you know?
My first introduction to Prince is when he was on Sesame Street.
Oh, my God. That's brilliant.
Isn't that funny?
That is brilliant.
Yeah. What year was he on Sesame
Street? I got to look that up.
I don't remember. But like that was the first time I remember. I was like, who the fuck is that guy?
Yeah,
because he's just such a weird larger than life character. And you know they have like celebrities on Sesame Street.
Yeah, I just of course remember Purple Rain, the movie.
Yeah.
Well, going to see that, my parents taking me to see that, which was
Wendy and Lisa. How to play guitar and look cool.
Yeah, I know. And then the only problem is this isn't Lake Minnetonka when he has her jump in. It's so good.
But you look and you like, you ever seen him play? Did you ever see him play live?
I don't think so.
He would do these gigs.
Oh, wait, no, at the Forum. I did actually see him. One of those last, like, handful of tours he probably did, I saw him.
What a guitar player.
It was amazing.
Probably one of the most underrated guitar players in the world.
Yeah.
And a natural drummer, a brilliantly natural funk drummer.
God, it's almost like he's underrated in every, like, because like you say, he is one of, he's touted like a guitar, I think, like, the most well-trained guitar players in the world will tell you he's touted as one of the best out there.
A friend of mine saw him recently in Vancouver and was saying, it's like, he played 6 or 7 nights in a row.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so what blew his mind is he could play about 19 different styles of guitar. He was playing everything from funk to country to heavy metal.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But at a level that people don't normally play any of them at.
Right.
You know, it's...
Right. That people can't play one, let alone all of them at...
A musical genius. And you go back and you realize that a lot of the... People don't really realize that a lot of the songs that were hits for a period of time were his.
Because of all the writing.
Yeah, there was, you know... For Sheryl Crow, for Sinead, obviously, for Nothing Compares to You, but there's so many hits that he wrote for other people.
Every
Day is a Winding Road is his. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, people forget.
Yeah. You know? He's like one of those guys too. I think his music is dated and timeless at the same time. I know that sounds like an oxymoron.
So it's on its own.
But yes, it is. Yeah. But like, do you understand like the tonal qualities of all of the things that he was doing, they just speak to that era so much that it's almost
There's one track to be on my desert island disc of all time.
What is it?
Sexy Motherfucker.
Sexy Motherfucker.
You don't know it?
No, I
my
can't think
6 year
of it.
Old was singing, "You sexy motherfucker."
What album is it on?
It's actually on B-sides because it was okay. Unbleeped. He did a video for it with, I think, a yellow Ferrari or something, and they put a scream in for Fucker. So it's you sexy mother, wow, and the scream is incredible.
Yeah, probably like right in time, pitch perfect.
And I can't find it because it was never released as a record.
Right,
it was only the video. And I think he deleted all of his stuff,
took
it out of everybody's hands.
Yeah.
And you start going, I've got to play you that track. You want to hear a drum track?
Did he record those drums?
Oh, yeah. It's like, it's backwards. It's like Diamonds and Pearls is so brilliant. You know that?
Yeah.
You listen to, you listen to Diamonds and Pearls?
Yeah, yeah.
Try to follow the bass drum pattern with the snare side here. It's like, holy crap, what are they doing? It's genius.
That's awesome. No, we'll have to check it out.
But that's, I'm definitely in the mood for Sexy Motherfucker. That's Sexy
Motherfucker. Sexy Motherfucker. And then... what was the one that Wisner always played at soundcheck? You remember that one?
The Prince tune?
Yeah. That was the first time I was like, okay, that's fucking awesome. And I can't find that song anywhere.
Is it the one that Josh would do? As Bargain Music?
I think so.
Yeah.
What's
it called? It's Something Ones. What's the track? It's got two words, the title.
Not sure.
It's another B-side type.
Another
type
one song. That you go like.
Yeah, it's the one where he starts like kind of almost screaming towards the end. Is it going to be him? Or is it going to be?
I don't know. I don't know it.
The Beautiful Ones?
I think that might be it.
I think it's called The Beautiful Ones. Yeah.
We could do this for days. Yeah. You know we could do this.
And there's the beauty in music, man.
That's what it's about.
Oh, it's so awesome. Yeah, I think it's called The Beautiful Ones. And Josh.
Hits the B-sides. There you go. I knew it would be on the
B-sides. Slow.
Sexy Motherfuckers on that.
Got Soft and Wet.
That's why they were all B-sides.
Yeah. Dirty Mind.
Have you got Sexy MF on there?
What was Prince's real name?
Yeah.
Listen. It's going to get you.
Sexy Motherfuckers. In a word or two, you, I want to do. No, not your body or mind. How's that? Fool. That delayed snare?
Sexy motherfucker. Baritone sax solo. Genius.
This is straight Sugar Hill Gang, like
almost but the jazz aspect.
Well, yeah, for sure. The vocal.
Wait for the guitar solo. You're like, I mean,
here you go. That's awesome.
It's so good.
That's so awesome. Right. It's better. This is what I'm here, baby. Yeah.
You sexy motherfucker. So, wait, guess what? We need to talk about things. Tell me what.
what you do. Tell me what you eat, I might cook for you.
Follow the bass.
It don't matter, cause it's all about me and you. Ain't no one else around. I'm even with the blindfold gagged and bound. I don't mind. See, this ain't about sex. It's all about love, being in charge of this and life and the next. While the cosmic talk, I just
those eighth notes on the
head. When we take that walk. Come here, baby. Yeah.
You sexy motherfucker. You sexy motherfucker.
So cool.
Yeah, like, yeah, I know.
I like it. And don't forget the organ in the back. Yeah, the background.
How's the pad in the back?
Just yeah.
The best ending you've ever heard. Ever.
Two big dudes screaming. Yeah. He's so good, man.
You sexy motherfucker.
I wonder who played drums.
Oh, yeah.
I think so, huh? So sick. Come here, Tommy.
Yeah. Oof.
The Batman in there real quick. So good.
Oh my god. It's nasty. Straight up like jazz guitar in the middle of a funk song.
Yeah. Who's that doing the gang vocals? Shaking that ass, shaking that ass. What year is this from? God, your folks addicted to honor. The sexy motherfucker's so fine. I'll drink a bath water. I'm long naked, 5'8", packing ass. His ties are great. I want to spit my game at a session. So, just cause. Cause I'm usually quite the calm one. You never found me a problem, boy. I'm just having fun. But I had to change the state of my life behind. I bet if you throw that ass in the air, it'll turn into sun. Hey, I think this song is what Flight of the Conchords based their whole musical career after.
Conchords are one of the greatest bands of all time.
So I saw them at the Greek Theater a couple years ago. It was brilliant.
Bowie.
Yeah, with that, it was just them on the two cajones. Oh. And it was, yeah.
That, was the that was most the, beautiful girl in the room.
Yeah. The whole, those two.
The whole wide room.
The two albums they put out, right?
The EP was first. They did an EP first, and they did an album. And they ran. Apparently they ran out of material, so they quit the show.
That's why?
Yeah, they didn't have time to write. It's exactly what we were talking about before, which was, you know, you have your whole life to write that first
chunk. Yeah, to your first album.
And then they kept putting, did you ever see the show? TV show?
I love show.
Right. The show is great. It took me two episodes to get in, but like the Aussie episode where the girl puts the cereal milk in the coffee.
Yeah. And when
God, that blew my mind.
And when Jermaine rolls in the full croc hunter gear or like because she's turning him Australian.
What I love is that his name's not Jermaine. It's Jermaine.
Jermaine.
Oh, yeah.
Jermaine.
Jermaine Clement.
Because they have the hardest. I mean, if you Australians think that New Zealanders have the worst accent in the world.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny.
And then Brett. Brit.
Brit. Oh, yeah, Brit.
Yeah, Brit.
Reece Darby is so funny.
Dude, he is hysterical. Oh, my God. He's so
He good. Did Leggy Blonde. He did the song Leggy Blonde for them.
He did?
Leggy. Blondie. That's one of the great songs ever. My kids know all the words to those songs, too.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great show. Reece Darby.
Come on, sucker, lick my battery. they're another sign. They are really true, a sign of the times. I was talking about Prince. I remember making a record with John Porter, being in the studio, and Sign of the Times came out. And yet, And I'm like, holy fuck, how do you make records like this?
Yeah.
You know when you're in the middle of the most creative point of what you're doing and you listen to somebody else's thing and you go like, oh shit, why do I bother?
Yeah. No matter,
you know what I mean?
No matter how good you get, there's always someone better, man.
Yeah. But there's a thing to, which is always, to me, the strive and the drive to be better.
Yeah, totally. It keeps the engines running, 100%.
Absolutely.
For sure.
But I'm not sure that's what everybody does now. I'm not sure that's what everybody wants now.
As far as that pushing each other to be better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. No, it is a beautiful thing. It's kind of.
You guys got a new record out, right?
Yeah. Well, we did Ohana. We put out about a year and a half ago. We just put out a single, actually. Which is an old Sugar My Knot tune
from
from 79 called Good Thing Going. And we have our buddy Miles from Slightly Stupid is on it and stuff. So that's the beauty about having this studio, man, is just and our own label and whatnot, is just the ability to do something like Kaleo put together this rad little demo of that cover, and we're like, oh well, let's get Miles to do on it. Okay, let's record it, let's put it out. Rad, you know,
Sugar Minor was sexy. That was so brilliant.
About yeah,
Sugar
Minor. I mean, that was around all the time of that Lover's Rock. It was coming in super hard for the reggae scene.
It was good, and it was because you go to a gig, they'd be like, go to the Brixton Academy, or you go somewhere like that, and it was just like the smoke, 18 feet yeah. of cubic yeah. feet of smoke.
And I would imagine all the girls loved that music too.
Everyone
right?
was just dancing, man. It was sexy yeah. and. It was like opening doors everywhere.
Yeah. Well, not Mitch over there. He was on the 2 and the 4, not dancing.
You're on the 2. hold on a second. Yeah. Reggae must have been really interesting for you.
Yeah. No, it's actually one of my favorite groups to play, oddly enough.
I think very early on I decided I wasn't very good at it, although I did a couple of reggae tracks. But I think I sort of left it to the people that...
Well, it's like we were talking about earlier, playing your strengths and what makes you sing and whatnot. You know what I mean? It's like a really good friend of ours that plays drums for Pennywise, Byron, and he's one of the greatest punk rock drummers in the world. And he admittedly can't really play reggae that great, but
it's not
his strength.
That's not his group.
Yeah. His drummer's in a reggae band. Like he can't do it.
Yeah.
Did I say his drummer?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. His brother is in a reggae band.
Yeah. 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 So he's, I've seen him play a couple songs with his brother's band, and yeah, it's just not his strong suit, but you give the guy any punk rock tune and he will blast out the most lightning fast, perfect fills you've ever seen.
That's
amazing.
That's a talent in another self.
Oh yeah.
And also
Byron actually puts his hi-hat pedal facing away from him too. I don't know if you've ever seen Byron play.
No, I haven't seen Byron's kit.
If you were to normally like have your pedal like this normally, he puts it like out like this and just kind of with the ball of his has the ball of his foot on it.
It just has rising and, a little strange.
Yeah,
I love stuff like that.
Yeah, and he uses those pedals that I don't know how he gets the fast doubles and whatnot on there. But what are those pedals called? Like
they're called Axis.
Yeah,
yeah, I've seen those.
They're like aluminum and they have an aluminum bar. So it's kind of like a strap. The action on it is, and his action specifically, I've tour managed and done front of house with those guys a few times and worked in the studio, and his action specifically is impossible to play. I feel like I could walk up to it. It's real hard, right? Yeah, I could probably walk up to any, most drummers' drum kits, and there'll be some awkwardness.
It's like putting on somebody else's underpants.
It's weird.
It is weird.
It's weird, but like you could still
be in anyone else's knickers.
You could go around for like an hour or so in those underwear.
Agreed. You know, and then you're like, I need to get back to my underwear.
Right. But his pedal, I can't do it.
Tony Thompson was like that. I tried to depress his bass drum pedal one time.
Who is this?
Tony Thompson. Great Tony Thompson. Yeah. He's a big boy. I could not depress.
Really?
He must have had quadruple springs on the thing. I literally was like, how the hell do you?
That's Byron.
Yeah.
Not only is it the action weird itself from the pedal,
it also comes back a long way.
It's well, no, because of the steel drive, it's very direct.
Oh,
you know what
no.
I mean?
That weird.
Yeah.
Drop.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
It's bizarre.
I love DW products. I think the bass drum pedals are probably the standard now for the world, the way they are. And they made a machine direct drive pedal. And I tried it. And I was like, what happened here?
Yeah.
And then they made the chain drive of the same thing. And it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And there's a weird thing about not having too much geometry in it.
Right.
And my problem is I'm one of those guys, I start fiddling and I don't know how to put it back to where it was.
No, I don't mess with it. Like,
Dude, that's so funny. I'm the same way. Yeah.
I use the
like, it doesn't work.
I use the Speed Cobra pedal, which is a longer one, and it actually has that little spring. But same thing. I've learned after I think two or three of them, I just take it out of the box and put it on the kick drum, and I'm good.
I've jacked them up and gone like, you know what's wrong with this?
You know what sucks is I was
chasing the ghost after that.
I was his drum tech for so long. I was a DW 9000 player.
Yeah.
And it's got that big heel on it and everything. And then he switches over to the freaking
flatboard. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no heel. And I got used to playing that. By
the
way,
just a quick pitch for DW. You can get that pedal with a flatboard. So
yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
And the long version.
Yeah.
Good to know, DW. All right.
I go on his kit for two tours, you know, haven't played my drums for a while. I go back to my DW and it's the most awkward feeling pedal I've ever felt. And it's not even DW's fault. It's just I got used to his pedal.
Totally different
thing. So I had to go out and buy a goddamn Speed Cobra for my kit.
You're gonna have to come back to the light side.
I know.
Come back to the light
side. You gotta help me out with that.
Step away. I got no pedals in my garage.
I got a DW pedal sitting like
right. I got a double pedal because everybody had one, and I was like, I need to know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And so I got one, and then unfortunately I bumped into Chris from Ocean's 8 Alaska, and I'm like, I give up. Have you seen that boy play?
Yes.
It's ridiculous. It is.
Really?
No, it's technically, I've never seen anybody that can do things with his hands and feet at that. It's not my thing. It's not my style of playing at all, but you look at his technical ability.
Well, it's probably someone like Luke, right? Like,
yeah. I love Luke. Yeah. Luke is one of my favorite people.
Yeah, and I saw him play with the project he has going with the guitar player, Jason.
Is it good?
It's insane. Like, it's so technically, it's a lot to take in. And because it's two of the most technically talented musicians in their own right, playing basically almost like solos.
I want to see together. Him playing Lover's Rock. I want to see Luke playing songs because he loves music like the rest of us.
Right.
And his technical ability is so great, and the video stuff he does.
Yeah.
I'm in awe of his natural talent 100%. And the work that he puts into what he's doing.
Yeah.
His technique is really interesting, that 12-9-3 thing, like how high from the skin you're hitting from. Uh-huh. See, mentally, he decides whether that's a 6-inch hit. Or a 3-inch hit, or
what?
Yeah, see, that's so. But that's a great example.
When he's practicing stuff, when doing stuff, he's like sort of going. He knows it's another angle to what he's doing. I can't do that.
It's so technical.
And I
look at
him and I go, it's brilliant.
Yeah,
but he's such a good feel player, and I just want to see him playing in a groove band because he'd be so good.
Yeah. I totally agree with that.
I'm not disrespecting that man's talent anyway. He is way ahead of me in ability and technical ability.
Yeah.
And he knows I love him as a player, but I'm like, he could play with anybody. He really could.
Anybody.
And he should be playing. He'd be great on pop music. He'd be great in, he's got that feel and that ability.
Which, I mean, it kind of gets close to the videos he does with the, you know, Kendrick Lamar. And
when he does the redos.
Yeah. Granted, he is putting his crazy, just amazing drum parts to
him. So you see a foot there, and you're like, what the hell? How do you do that?
Yeah, it makes me rethink my own drumming.
Makes you
want to
go practice.
Yeah, exactly.
It's literally gone, shit.
Yeah. It's amazing. Great.
I feel the same way about Royster and those guys. You look and you go, it's fabulous. I love the stuff he did with Jay-Z. I thought it was really brilliant to do the live stuff with Jay-Z. He was really, really good in that. But otherwise, I find it a little hard to assimilate that technique into music.
Uh-huh. That's because you like the meters.
Yeah, Zigaboo is one of the greatest, greatest drummers of all time.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever kept time with anyone but himself.
Yeah. Right. And like that, I would love to see those drummers who rip like that play in those contexts. Because I think they can do it, but it's so different. Like the speed and the accuracy that they possess isn't really there in the meters, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It's just feel at that point.
Yeah.
You're listening to something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you made a great point at the beginning of your 2 and 4 point is the truth. It's like, and reggae, you can't, it's not about rigidity. There's no chart. You can't have rigidity and reggae doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's flow, man. It's all about flow.
You can't beat Dr. Reggae, man.
No.
It's like ocean. It's what it is.
It's a feeling.
Fun. Yeah. I think that's what it's about. Now we've ragged on all these drummers. It's great.
Oh, I'm not ragging on them. Definitely not ragging on them.
That's the beautiful thing about drumming and just music in general is there's for you put it in an analogy for drummers, there's always your Neil Peart and your John Bottoms. You know what I mean? There's always going to be the feel and the technical side of it, and then those right in betweens too that split the difference.
What is Josh Freese then? Since we have to spend at least 5 minutes talking about Josh
on every single podcast,
yeah,
I think he's wonderful. I think he's, I think he's an, I think he is one of the new era of great drummers.
Yeah,
if you were going to start a Buddy Rich, a contemporary Buddy Rich, that's who he'd be. It's not about just, it's not about technique, although he had bags of technique.
Yeah,
you watch him plan; he's got fantastic feel. Ash is his own area of brilliance,
right?
But it fits a very specific area. Although, have you heard him play with his side project, his rock band?
No.
It's like, oh my God, you do that too? I mean, it's effortless for him.
Right.
He's a musical drummer. He plays on the
Voice too.
Yeah.
Which
plays everything.
Everything. I mean, have you ever watched, I can't think of the drummer for the Voice, the American version, but that guy is ridiculous
too.
He's
a brilliant player.
I think he does a few too many stick twirls personally, but hey.
He's trying to be interesting.
Yeah, he's trying to get out there, you know?
Right, right. That's his
That's his thing. It's just because I can't do it. That's why I don't.
Maybe that's why I don't like it.
Are we jealous?
Well, see, speaking of, and Luke, Josh Freese, they're all so good at the stick tricks too, man. Oh, the damn bounce. It.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going, really? How much time do you have? No, you know what kills me about those guys, about those guys, is they learn so quickly.
Yeah.
That's what gets me.
Yeah.
I'm like, what did we do to ourselves that we can't learn that fast?
Yeah.
I think we killed some portions of our brains.
I always find that out, growing up surfing, I always find that out about some of my friends that you can just, they just naturally can surf so much better than other people that, like myself, that have to like really practice and concentrate to even stand up on a wave kind of deal.
48 years old, I got on a snowboard and went down Mammoth. My oldest kid gets on a snowboard, jumping in a day.
Yeah.
That's who he does. He could surf, he'd do anything, plays football, does stuff. And I'm like, I'm going down a hill at 65 miles an hour flat. And a guy I paid to instruct me is going, you need to turn, sir, because you're going to die.
Yeah.
Like,
you don't want to pull
it. I'm just, there's some things I just can't do.
That's me with surfing. I want to surf so badly, but I.
You want that thing?
That thing. Problem is, it just never, the motion of laying flat on a surface in water.
Yeah,
and it's then awkward. Standing onto said surface and riding and moving water.
Yeah. And that's never the same. It's like never, from second to second, it's never the same. A good friend of mine, Shane Dorian, who's a really successful big wave surfer, he put it in perspective one day back in Hawaii. He was talking about just the act of paddling on a surfboard and having your neck upward and held back like that for so long. It's such an awkward position for the human body. It's not natural. And it's just using those muscles you never use in anything else. Right?
Yeah, it's crazy. Hey,
speaking of Josh Freese, real quick, are you a Frank Zappa fan?
Huge Zappa fan.
Okay,
but in the weirdest way.
Because I'm a huge Ween fan, and I've heard that people that love Ween also they'll move on and or move behind and get really into Frank Zappa because it's a lifelong commitment. I've also heard.
The thing about Zappa for me is the Bozio years of Zappa are mind blowing to me. With Vi and those guys, and you watch the interviews. But do you ever hear about Vi's audition?
Is that the great story?
Because he was a Valley Boy guitarist.
Yeah,
that everyone went, this guy's incredible. You got to have him in a band. Frank brought him to the audition, and he goes, great. Okay, playing 7/8. Plays in 7/8. Sheet music up for stuff. There's a huge band in there. He's got great play. 7/8 halftime. Okay. Put a B in that. Okay. Now do it in reggae. Okay, fine. Now do it. Now add a F sharp. And he's going, you can't do that. He got to the point where he's going, you can't do that. He goes, really? Yeah, what was the line? He said, I hear Karen Carpenter's looking for a guitar player. No, Linda Ronstadt. I hear Linda Ronstadt's looking for a guitar player. Linda Ronstadt's looking for a guitar player.
Even better.
He's like, oh, fuck.
I'll find a way to put the F in.
No. It was impossible to play. He was just fucking with him.
Oh.
And he was like, so he gets to the end of the hour and packs his stuff and says, thanks very much. And he goes, where the fuck are you going? Because you're in the band.
Wow.
Sick.
That's crazy.
And you look at Zappa's stuff and you go, he was a musical genius. And and people forgot the fact that he was a musical genius, because that was a time in music where we weren't allowed to have musical geniuses. It was bands. It was a weird thing. Music was for everybody, and it was all simple and
right.
popular and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and Zappa was appearing on...
It was before a Prince came along.
Yeah, but he was 20 years before he should have been there.
Uh-huh.
You look at him on chat shows in the 60s, and he's not supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
He's 10 years too early for what he's doing, playing a bicycle on a talk show. Playing a bicycle right, as okay. a song. And you're like...
That's amazing.
And the Black Page, the reason why the Black Page is called the Black Page... is because there's so many dots on it, it looks like a black page. And it was about making, I think it was about, if you really look, it was about making Terry Bozzio play something he'd never played before that was impossible to play. And it is the most complicated piece of music. Pull it up, anytime you watch him play it live, yeah. you're going, how the hell would you remember these parts? And Bozzio's not looking at charts. He's not yeah. looking at any charts.
Do you know Ryan Brown?
I know who Ryan Brown is.
Yeah. He's the drummer for yeah. His son.
Dweezil.
Oh,
and
Dweezil's an amazing guitar player.
Plays all the Zappa stuff.
Yeah. Dweezil can play his dad's stuff. It's like, it's.
But yeah.
Frank is about, he used to crush music. He's the Stanley Kubrick of music. That's who he was.
Yeah.
He would take it apart, pull it apart, make it impossible, take it beyond that, bring in weird orchestral people.
Would you say that's a really good analogy? Because that's what Stanley Kubrick did to Tom Cruise and
destroyed him. If he never got to cut the film.
Right.
Would you say he almost, like, in a sense, came the closest to mastering music?
I think
he was deconstructing it, putting it back together.
I think he was Mozart. I think he was literally whatever was going on in that man's head. He was a genius. He was an absolute genius.
But he had genius. Like a comedic side to him, like that.
Wicked.
Yeah. That.
Yeah. Just, what's the one song that Cousin Eric always?
Oh, the Hey, I'll Buy You a Pizza.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Album titles used to make me giggle. And then you listen to the playing, but what a guitar player.
Yeah.
But he was a. He was an orchestrator. He used to orchestrate all those parts, and he wrote all those parts. So there's sheet music out there of pieces that he's done that you realize he's written 30 parts to.
Yeah,
that's Mozart, dude. That's not normal behavior in a rock band.
Right.
And he got out of Bozzio when Bozzio was like 19 years old playing with him.
Yeah.
He got him to play stuff that nobody else has ever been able to do.
Wow.
So my buddy Ken, the same guy that the Ziggy Stardust, he did. He lived across the street. From Frank Zappa.
Oh, the guy that produced Spiders from Mars, yeah.
And obviously during the 70s, he and Frank became friends. Their kids were friends. Like, what's Moon?
Moon Unit, Zappa
was friends with Ken's daughter and whatnot. And one day Frank comes over and he's like, hey, Ken, I got another band for you to check out. And Ken walks over and it's Terry Bozzio and his wife.
Dale.
Mm-hmm.
And Missing Persons.
And became Missing Persons. And so Ken produced and managed Missing Persons.
That's why, yes. He was
for those years. Yeah. In fact, the only way they got him out of his contract is because he accidentally booked a show for them.
And illegal. So that's illegal, yeah.
It's illegal for
Is that managers. Just a state? Is that just the state of California?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why you have to have bookers.
That's why you have to have agents.
Yeah,
no, totally.
And it's a fixed rate commission fee for agents.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
It has to be 10%. Can't be more.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Oh man, God! If I could go back and get checks from all the people that didn't pay me what they were supposed to pay me, I'd be a very wealthy man. Yeah. But they don't have the money.
Yeah,
that's the scary thing. They don't have the money. So Matt, Terry, he did that Brecker Brothers live album, which is unbelievable. East River and Terry playing drums. There's a certain era of Terry playing drums. There's nobody could play like him.
Yeah.
He branches off. He has that technical thing and he has that tonal thing that he does. It's like Copeland. Copeland had went into, I can't be disrespectful to Mr. Copeland. I saw him play drums recently in a house. And I was like, I don't see how he's changed very much in what he's done.
Right.
But I've seen a lot of drummers evolve beyond that. You look at someone like Josh and you go, Josh could play with anybody. He could play with the Police. He could play with anybody. It's that there's something about, he's fantastic in that way.
Yeah.
My buddy, Christoph, you know, Christoph Ball. Hairdresser, Christoph.
Oh, yeah.
Cake Boy.
Uh-huh.
In the band Cake Boy. He's like, he's always, Josh played with him a few times and stuff.
So. Yeah, but Josh is crazy because he can, like, he's got such a signature style of his own, but he can also play, he can mirror other people.
He's a mimic.
But some people can only do one or the other, you know? So it's really mind-blowing to watch at times.
I was talking to my 12-year-old about practice. He's like, there's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and he does... He's a fencer of all things.
Wow.
It's really good.
And he hates, ahead of his time, huh?
And he hates. They're both thinking men's sports.
So yeah, big time. It's like chess.
He's a, but he hated practice, and he got beaten recently in a fencing tournament by a big, taller kid than him, and the kid came hard at him after my son Will had got him, had tagged him, and the guy got mad and came at him, and Will ended up losing the bout. I said, "Tell me how you could have beaten him." And he told me how he could have beaten him 3-4 different ways. I said, "That's the fun part that you're going to be working on, is that you know, you keep telling me how you could have beaten him." And I'm not trying to get down on you or anything like that, but isn't it interesting that you can do that? And he was talking about practice, and he said, "It's just that we don't learn anything in practice."
Mm-hmm.
And because I never practiced when I was drumming, I never practiced because I played a lot, but I didn't need to, but I was also afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know where my limits were. And I said to him, I said, "We practice so that when the amazing moment comes up that you're given this opportunity to drop something in, be you a drummer or be you anything else, you're not on the wrong foot. You're not unable to play it.
Right.
Your left hand isn't dragging 3 inches behind you where right. you want it to be.
The preparation.
We practice so that it's effortless when we go in to do it. And it's a giving action. It's the sacrifice of your time with the ability to be in the moment when you're doing what it is that you do and you love it. And that's the hardest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I have so much respect for people who learn how to surf older or learn how to, you know what, I can't play big band music, but I'm going to learn how to play it.
Mm-hmm.
I go, that's an incredible thing to do, to have to be able to read charts and be able to do stuff.
What's his name?
Chris.
Neil Peart.
Oh.
Neil Peart, yes.
He reached out to Buddy Rich and was like, "Show me the way."
Oh, yeah.
Why would... my whole life has been categorized by being too afraid to do things like that.
Yeah.
And the joy is actually going, why not? Why the hell not try it?
Yeah, no, when you first said that, I was on the last episode, Chris from OAR,
Was he on the last episode?
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't aired yet.
Yeah, the last recorded.
The most technical drummer in the history of drummers and a great rock climber.
Yeah.
No,
I'm thinking of Ocean State, Alaska. Chris OAR.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chris, the drummer of OAR.
Right, good band.
Yeah, and he, a handful of years into their career, like when they'd already seen a bunch of success, he went back in and went through some full-blown training after he could have just, you know.
All the great drummers we know went back to somebody and went like, "Show me how to do that."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I couldn't play a Purdy shuffle before about a year and a half ago because I never tried it. And when I worked it out backwards. I made it the most complicated thing I've ever done in my entire life.
You took the long road.
And I put the Purdy video on and watched the Purdy video and went, "Oh my God, this is so easy." And played it. But it took me 4 weeks to play it like I've been playing it for 20 years.
Right.
It's like, oh, it's easy. It's effortless when you do it right. And that's the fun thing about coming back to it.
Yeah.
Not as a kid, but coming back to it as an adult.
Seeing the results too. Yeah. I had an idea, like, you should videotape yourself. If you're going to practice and do videotape yourself doing it day one. Day one.
Mm-hmm.
And then videotape yourself after practicing every day, being rigid and actually, you know, practicing. And then videotape yourself a week later. And then watch those two right
now. Is that working out?
Yeah.
You will see something.
And you have to take yourself out of it like you're talking about and watch yourself, though.
Yes.
Because then you can't really, like, can I mean, I process. Hate to bring it back to, but like surfing or golfing or anything like that, you can't really, at least me personally, lock in the mistakes or the right things I'm doing until I step outside and see myself doing it, like a video or something like that.
You know what's funny about
That's
music?
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I kind of realized, oddly enough, podcasting. I did a sports podcast for a while with Matt Leinart, who was a pro for USC. He played football for USC, won the Heisman.
Yeah, he did.
And Matt, every time we released an episode, was hounding me for numbers. How did it do? How did it respond? And I realized, I'm like, this motherfucker, his entire life has been focused on numbers. He could not measure success unless he had 4 touchdowns in a game, through 375 yards. Like, those numbers meant something to him. And in music, there isn't a way to really measure how good you are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I was like, man, like, I've never thought of it that way. This guy has to have that feedback in order to see his progress and see what...
It's fascinating.
It's hard for us to get to that point.
But then you look at the greatest quarterbacks And that's not true.
Right.
Because Marino would always be Marino. Thingy from 49ers.
Montana
and Rice, right?
Yeah.
So Montana, he could have a shitty game. He was still Montana. There were still moments in every game
right.
where he was like, I can put that ball in that man's
cover
hands.
Your ears, G, but right. Aaron Rodgers is kind of like
that. Yeah, I know.
God, that game this weekend killed me.
Yeah.
It was a yes, I watched that. There's a few. And the greatness is not because they're not thinking about the numbers. It's the right. joy of going, I'm gonna do that and yeah. do it. And
right.
do it.
That's very
it's got
true.
Nothing to do with how am I doing.
It's,
and that's what kills people is yeah. how am I doing?
Yeah. But in a
that's when you that's when you start the whole comparing thing and competition comes in mm-hmm. your mind and then well, was it Rick Rubin? I remember watching, I think it was the Tim Ferriss podcast, and he asked him how he approaches producing artists. And he says, you know, once someone, artistic mind hits the point of they're competing with someone else or they hear an outside thing they want to be better than, then he's pretty much like, oh, it's kind of ruined already because he wants to avoid that type of thing. So,
yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's funny those just.
I get fiercely competitive now because I haven't played in so long.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's emotionally meaning so much to me
mm-hmm.
that I'm taking it a little too seriously at times.
Does that equate? That probably equates on you being harder on yourself too, right?
Yes, I try not to be, but I think so. But it's like there's a part of me that's very childish about that. And the good news is being older is I can look at it and go, I need to calm down, get a sense of humor about this because it's, remember, it's a joyous thing to do. And it's to get to do something you love doing is an incredible thing.
Mm-hmm.
To get paid to do something you love doing is mind-blowing to me. Mm-hmm. It is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, it's a big, big deal.
Yeah. I know it is hard to soak in too. It's mind-blowing and it's very, to my personal experience with being able to do something you love for a living, it's super surreal. And it never really soaks into me, you know.
It's very humbling.
Yeah, I'm like, this is, I don't really get it. It's amazing, and it's such a blessing. But
to walk down the street and have people say, "I love your work," or it's incredible to me. I'm public enough that it happens to me, and it happens to me every single day wherever mm-hmm. wherever I might be, and I have people asking me, like, "You don't find that an imposition?" I'd be in an airport. The other day I was at the airport and it was like, can I take a picture? I'm like, of course. It's people don't understand that without the fans that we have, we don't have anything. Mm-hmm. It's entirely, it's an organic transaction between us and the people we're mm-hmm. doing it for.
Yep. Yeah.
If we do it on our own. It's like, it's okay. But that's a rehearsal.
Yeah.
When you put it out there and you put your heart in it and you put your love in it, you send it out there. Doesn't matter what it is. You tell the story, you put it out. You're going, and they give you that love back. It's the greatest thing in the world. And it's, you know, to stop and say thank you. Anybody who doesn't do that's an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Or afraid. Well, sometimes they're afraid.
Absolutely. Benefit of the doubt. And but that's like you're saying that when that gets lost between the people that are lucky enough to be in the position that it's the fans that are making this happen. And if it wasn't for them, when that gets lost, then that's just such a bummer. And like you're saying, those are the people that suck.
Yeah.
But conversely, I've discovered that you can't try to appease them with your art. You have to be true and honest to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But the very reason that they enjoy what it is that you do, if they enjoy what it is that you do, if you're lucky enough to have people enjoy your work,
yeah.
You can't suddenly go, you know what would make them happy? Or you know what would be really cool or what I could sell more of? Never seems to work.
Yeah.
It only seems to be
because that's not the truth.
No, exactly. Chuck Jones, who's the most prolific filmmaker in the history of American film, who created The Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote and all those fun things, said he was working for Tex Avery back in the day. He said he used to go to the movie theater and watch what people laughed at and take notes, write down the notes of what they thought was funny. He said, I proceeded to make the worst films I ever made in my entire career.
Really?
Because when I did what made me laugh, it kind of worked out.
Yeah,
right.
And that's the joy and the truth of it.
Yeah, and I think that's just part of the general public. It's like they can sniff the bullshit. Like yes. when a band's going through the motions on stage and not having fun, the audience can tell.
It dips. It's painful.
Yeah, totally.
I've seen boos on those. Jeez. I've seen boos on those. People having a meltdown on stage.
Yeah. I know, and it becomes awkward for the whole for the whole situation.
It's a joyous thing.
Oh,
this was fun, man.
Yeah, all right, man. We're gonna that. I mean, what you just said before about you know being at the airport and that whole the organic exchange, and that's what it's all about. I want to end on that note because that was so amazingly beautiful, and it really is what it's all about, and why we're all able to be sitting in this room talking to each other and having
you
a blast.
You sexy motherfucker.
Yeah. You sexy motherfucker.
I feel like we should play out with that
song. Yeah, hit it out. Let's. One last huge mahalo to you, Brother Mark, for coming in and taking the time today. Thanks to Brother Mitch over here for always coming in the clutch with the co-host. And we will leave on You Sexy Motherfucker.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening to this episode of Disposable Heroes. We want to thank Mark Shepherd for coming on. We really enjoyed hanging out with him, and we hope that he comes back again soon. In the meantime, would you guys mind heading over to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever and leaving us a review? That would mean the world to Yassad and myself. And stay tuned because we've got a bunch of really awesome episodes coming up. I think we're going to start pushing for once a week if we can. Yassad and my schedules are pretty busy, but we'll see what we can do. In the meantime, thanks again. See you soon.